Roger Thompson joins us this morning on the phone. Hey, Roger, good morning, and thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. Super pleased to be with you.
You titled your book, No Word for Wilderness, which, of course, is the question that then you must answer over and over and over when you do interviews like this. Italian has no word for wilderness. As a student of words and of culture, what does that mean to you?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, the point of the book, in part, is to just point out that if you have a culture that doesn't actually have language to describe a certain phenomenon, and for an American, the idea of the wilderness is kind of writ into our psyche, even from our founding. But Italy is a place of great civilization and founding of culture. And while there are other civilizations also that don't have words for wilderness, the fact that Italy doesn't, when you talk about conservation then in Italy, especially with large animals and large mammals, issues become very complicated very fast. If you think about in the U.S. the difficulty we might have around preservation of certain types of species, large animal species, if you're talking about that, you're usually trying to talk about the need to preserve some aspect of wilderness. If you do not have the word for wilderness, then how does your culture rally around a certain species to help preserve it?
There was an expression, and I've forgotten it now, and I'm going to have to send him an email and double-check it. Years ago, the director of our zoo, Mike Janis, did a regular feature on this program, and he talked about something about charismatic vertebrates or something. And the idea, I think I've got the words wrong, but the idea was pandas and gorillas and some of these animals that are very charismatic and that people really are interested in, invested in. And it's, for example, a lot easier to try to drum up support for an animal like this than it would be for a snail darter or plant, for example. Yeah. So when people do start talking about conservation, for example, for something that in America people would completely get behind, a bear. Wow.
Yes, yes.
Is it the same visceral reaction by human beings toward this animal, or because of the cultural difference, the reaction isn't similar?
Yeah, that's a really fascinating and it's a really good question. I talk a little bit in the book about what it takes to go through a process of really getting a culture focus on preserving a species, and I contrasted a little bit in the complications that you have with certain species in the U.S. So in West Virginia, for instance, there's a cheat mountain salamander, and the cheat mountain salamander turned out to be in the way of development of a ski resort in West Virginia, and of course, people who have particular concerns about salamanders or just have a certain kind of type of green ethic that might have them be interested in preserving most species, when you have a bunch of people whose livelihoods depend on developing that land, who may have sunk some money into it, or who might see possibility for long-term, more stable jobs coming to a very poor area, how do you make the case to preserve something like a salamander? And I bring that up just because in Italy, the notion of even preserving a bear, especially an animal that is a brown, so these bears are brown bears. They're 50 miles from Rome. There's about 50 of them left. They are a very distinctive subspecies. But brown bears writ large are not endangered animals. So how do you get organizations, how do you get groups of people interested in the preservation of those animals? If worldwide the brown bear is not an endangered animal, how do you make the case in a locality to preserve it? Now, in Italy, there's at least some sense of pride with these bears. They are special bears. They are they're different on a genetic level. They are different at a behavioral level. In 1,000 years of recorded history, written history, we have no record of an attack on a human being by these brown bears, and yet you're in one of the most densely populated countries in Europe. So how did that happen, and do these bears deserve some sort of preservation then? In Italy, that question is a complicated one, simply because for many Italians, the idea of being in the wilderness, being out in some sort of natural place and experiencing it just for the sake of nature, this is a quaintly American, maybe Northern European idea. It is not an Italian idea. And yet the bears are large, they're gentle, and they're large, you know, they're basically vegetarians.
Well, and of course, for many people, there is this draw to animals. Without getting into a lot of detail in this direction, I'm curious, what is the relationship that Italians have with companion animals? Do they like to have dogs? Do they like to have cats? Yep. I mean, are they open to thinking outside the species box in terms of affection and connection?
Yes. I mean, this is, in fact, some of my friends joke that, you know, one of the for however wonderful the Italian kitchens are and places to eat and restaurants, you know, you can go into many places and people will have their dogs with them in the restaurants. And for some people, this is very distressing. They don't like the idea. But,
well, they can just eat outside in the street then if they're so picky.
That's my feeling of it, as any dogs are welcome at my table, certainly. So there is a certain type of relationship there that is, open to that, and indeed, again, I like this idea that you were bringing up earlier, it's kind of saying charismatic species. For this type of bear in particular, because it's a friendly bear, and, you know, as far as bears go, again, this is, I'm using that word very loosely, the Italian culture has, the Italians have a name for it. They call him Father Bear, and the idea is that he is kind of this apex creature, certainly, but also one deserving of respect and providing even kind of a paternalistic metaphor for how we kind of live in our world, which is, yes, you need your space to move around, but also, and this is what's so interesting and what we can really learn from the Italians here, is somehow this bear species, despite being 50 miles from Rome, has persisted, has somehow survived millennia. And if we can understand how a bear like this has been able to persist in the face of civilization and development, then Italy really does have a really special lesson to give us.
I think that right off the top of my head, it seems that the lesson is we're not outdoors people. We stay in town. And without encroaching into the bear's habitat, it would seem to me that that would be that'd be like a big key to the puzzle. Stay out of their space.
Well, there is some truth to that, but there's also this notion. In Italy, there's this idea of the nature tax in this area of Abruzzo. And the idea of the nature tax is that if you're going to do business in bear territory, and by that I mean simply live in bear territory, that you owed a certain type of tax to nature.
Wow.
So it's a really lovely kind of romantic idea. So if you had a little farmstead, if you had an orchard, you'd plant a couple extra apple trees at the edge of the property. That's the nature tax. Those are for the bear. If you had an apiary, you would put in a couple extra hives out at the edge. And those, again, those were for Father Bear. And the idea here, of course, is that you pay essentially a tithe to be in that territory in some sort of way. And this, apparently, the bears have rather agreed with this arrangement. Again, we have no record of hostile interactions except in instances where a human has attempted to poach a bear or something like that. And in all other instances, the bears go about their business and have no need or desire to bother the human habitat.
And so some of the issues that we have in America, frequently it has to do with predation on livestock, which ends up being a huge economic impact on the farmer or the rancher there. And that doesn't seem to be the issue. I have to ask, before I let you go, How does, because of course we in America have, you know, stereotypical ideas about things because we learn what we learn about other cultures, many of us from television and movies. But how does the mafia fit into this? And,
right.
and it's so, like, oh my gosh, bears in the mafia. This could, it's like, why isn't that the title of your book, Bears in the Mafia?
It's a great question. And part of that is because when I started this project, is to be simply talking about these two species of brown bears that live in Italy, one the rewilding attempt of the one of these Abruzzo bears who are kind of they're clinging to existence now at this point. And the reason they're clinging to existence is because the mafia has become involved in Italy in cattle ranching. And basically there are groups of cattle ranchers who are illegally grazing cattle on national park lands. It's free. It's free grazing. Part of this is writ into the Italian code, where a certain amount of land can be used for public use, regardless of where it is. And so, this is being exploited, and the ranchers are running essentially free on land throughout the national parks, and then they are sluicing EU beef subsidies into the coffers. The guy who discovered this being done is a guy named Giuseppe Antaci, and Antaci believes that the first year alone that he understood what was going on when he finally did a study on this, from his park alone, which is in Sicily, they were probably taking on the order of 86 million euros from 1 year. He now estimates that those numbers are over a billion a year if you take into account all the different parks that the mafia seems to be functioning in. Around the industry of cattle grazing.
Roger, the one final question I'll ask you is not an easy answer because if it was, we would have solved it by now, obviously.
Yes.
But what can everyday people do when they feel as though they value something kind of ineffable, like wilderness, or even the preservation of a very specific species like these brown bears, and they come right up against financial interests, whether it's a financial interest of the neighbor who's maybe got a job, somebody that you like who has a job, or some big faceless corporation that wants to make billions and you'll never see a dime of it. We confront this a lot in our lives. And it's almost as though when the argument or the debate takes place, it's almost as though people are speaking two separate languages.
Yeah.
How do we try, how do we begin to reconcile? How do we begin to bring these concerns together and work toward a mutual solution? Or by the nature of what we're talking about, is there no solution?
Yeah, that's, I'm Pollyanna enough to always think there's a solution. And I'm a great believer in kind of the ability of local people to be involved at the table. I think it does get more complicated when interests not from the local community are involved in activities in the region. But that's, you know, that's normal. And so how do you kind of negotiate that? The key thing, if you're on the side of, and of course, this, you're right, this is not not to be solved in any quick way. If someone had figured this out a long time ago, we'd be in good shape.
However, it would be really good for us here at KUMD going into a membership drive. If we could solve this on this interview, that would really look good for us and be a great fundraising tool. So
we'll
just want to give you a heads up that if you want to just take a stab at it, please feel free to go ahead.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The you know, you need to have whistleblowers for people breaking the law, certainly. In Italy, the local whistleblowers is not enough, so you need international intervention, and that's part of what this book is about. But I think the key part on the side, and it's one of the lessons we can take out of Italy, is that there still must be pathways for, so if you're trying to create some sort of environmental regulation or trying to create a pathway for preservation, you have to provide ways for the people who will be impacted in their livelihoods. And in Italy, this is very high stakes. You know, it's a country with significant financial issues and longstanding problems. Abruzzo is one of the poorest, where these bears are, is one of the poorest provinces. So what do you do? And they'd had a park director previously who's very smart about this and seeing the possibility for a green economy in the area. and essentially redeploying some of the peoples in different types of jobs. Now, in Italy, there's ways in which that can be state-run that in the states is inherently complicated because of the nature of our politics. But the point is he was trying to involve them in the actual solution as opposed to kind of setting up a situation where either he was right and they were wrong or they were right and he was wrong. And it really, you know, this is not an easy process, and it's certainly not one that, I mean, there's plenty of issues. I think if I got family in Ely and the logging industry or the mineral issues recently, BWCA. And so how do you talk about the possibility of jobs in areas that haven't had it for some time? While also preserving some of the things that make those tourist destinations, but more importantly, if you have some other notion of kind of inherent value to the natural world, how do you provide pathways for those people so that they can buy into the story that you're trying to tell about that region? It's no easy solution, certainly.
Roger, I'd love the opportunity, of course, to we'd love to talk about this forever, but there is a lot of ground yet to cover. And yet, of course, we're out of time because that's the way it works. Thank you so very much, though, for joining us this morning. What a treat.
Really appreciate the time, and great to hear from Duluth.
Roger Thompson is the author of a book called No Word for Wilderness. He joined us this morning as our guest on Northland Morning.